broadcast service of City College and the San Diego Community College District. This is Jazz FM 88.3 KSDS San Diego. I'm Dave Drexler with Inside Art. Support for Inside Art comes from the members of San Diego's Jazz 88.3. This week on Inside Art, we'll preview Beyond Prison Walls, a festival of short plays by playwrights from Donovan and Centinela Prison staged at San Diego State University. But first, saxophonist and USC Assistant Professor of Music Jonathan Gomez comes to the Athenaeum Music and Arts Library Monday, April 10th for a special lecture on jazz in the 1920s as part of the Talk of the Town honoring the Athenaeum's historic 1921 William Templeton Johnson Building in downtown La Jolla. Jonathan Gomez studies Black American music of the 20th and 21st centuries, plus music of the African diaspora. He received his doctorate in music from Harvard, a master's from Michigan State, and his bachelor's in studio music and jazz from the University of Miami's Frost School of Music. Jonathan, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Jazz 88.3 and Inside Art.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jonathan, maybe we can start with sort of the political, social, economic conditions that gave rise to jazz in the roaring 20s, the jazz age.
Sure. So the 1920s is an interesting time. You know, jazz and sort of the early rumblings or developments that would lead to what we now hear as jazz began before the 1920s. And actually, the first jazz recordings were made before the 1920s as well. They were made in 1917 by the original Dixieland jazz band. But the biggest development that we have in the 1920s is the expansion of access to recording technology and the recording industry. And so, you know, the first jazz recordings by Black musicians were made in the early 1920s. In 1922, Kid Ory, a trombonist, made a recording, Ory's Creole Trombone. And then 1923, King Oliver, who was also a New Orleans musician but was living in Chicago at the time, made his first recordings featuring a young Louis Armstrong. And so that expansion to Black musicians is really, I think, a key part of what was happening, at least in the early 1920s.
So when jazz is really starting to flourish in the 1920s, is that a sign that American society in general is becoming more interested in African-American culture?
Well, yes and no. There was an interest in Black culture, which I think has existed since, you know, far earlier than the jazz age, but an interest and a respect for is a little bit, are slightly different. And so what I mean is that, you know, the 1920s were coming after the height of blackface minstrelsy was the middle of the 19th century, but there were still remnants of these particular kind of stereotypical ideas about Blackness and about that were attached to Black music. So you'll see something like in Ladies Home Journal, for instance, there was an article by someone named Ann Shaw Faulkner that asked, the title was, it was something like, does jazz put the sin in syncopation? And so there were these, you know, questions and qualms about what does Black music do to, particularly to youth and to women. And so while there was an interest, it was sort of contested, right? And and this is how we end up with jazz and speakeasies or people going uptown, right, to hear, in, if we're talking about New York, going uptown to hear the music, and then you would go back downtown later.
I'm also interested in how jazz culture within the musicians themselves infected the entire language of American style English.
Oh, sure. That's a good point. Yeah, I think the language used by jazz musicians, I mean, I would say maybe by Black Americans broadly, but especially by jazz musicians, yeah, started to catch on as something that was trendy or hip. And eventually Cab Calloway, I'm not remembering the year, this might have been in the 30s, but Cab Calloway published the Hepcats Dictionary that had a lot of these slang terms in it. So, or things that, you know, at the time were considered slang and now are a regular part of our language.
And the music development itself, though, during this period, maybe you can give an overview of what you're going to discuss in your lecture here.
Sure. So one of the things that's always interested me, and I think that we can see across, is because of the intersections with sound technology, people recorded tended to record earlier in the 1920s in smaller groups, which was indicative of like how bands were in New Orleans or in some of the smaller venues that they would play in. But as the decade progresses, bands began to expand, which is not to say that there weren't larger bands already, but recording technology got better, and so it was easier to record these groups. Gunther Schuller, in his early jazz book, writes about the rise of the jazz composer, and he talks about Jelly Roll Morton and some of these other musicians. But there is the expansion of groups, I think, is an important point. And so something like King Oliver's group had, you know, 5 or 6 people in it. Louis Armstrong would eventually break off, and he had his Hot 5 ensemble and then Hot 7 ensemble. And then in New York, there were like Duke Ellington's band started, first in Washington, D.C., but then in New York, was a smaller group and began to expand by the end of the century to closer to what we would see as a big band, but still smaller, still slightly less people. And so there was not only, there was something about compositions, right? This is why Duke Ellington is such an important figure. It's like he's writing these pieces for this ensemble. Same with other groups that maybe get a little bit less attention, but somebody like Fletcher Henderson and his lead arranger, Don Redman, who were, you know, they were a very popular group in New York at the time as well, and made really great recordings that I think sometimes get overlooked. And so I think that's part of the musical development. The other thing that's happening is with, particularly with Louis Armstrong, or catalyzed by him, we could say, is more attention on jazz soloists. And so when we think about jazz, often people think of it as a soloist music. You know, people play in a group and then a soloist kind of emerges. That idea is not quite as concrete as people tend to think that it is, but there's a lot more interaction and things happening underneath. But with Louis Armstrong making these Hot 5, Hot 7 recordings, even when he was playing with King Oliver, his solo on, you know, these different things, there was attention to like, okay, what are these soloists doing? And by the end of the decade, we get his recording of West End Blues, which was a huge inflection point in jazz history. He takes this really incredible trumpet introduction into the piece. He plays the melody, and then there's a beautiful piano solo by Earl Hines. And so that kind of stuff going into the 1930s, I think, is important, is how are we seeing how the ensembles increase in size and the importance of compositions and arranging, and then also this simultaneous attention to soloists emerging from the kind of ensemble textures, whether it's a small group or a big band.
Well, meanwhile, while these artists are becoming the legends who they eventually became, they're undergoing a lot of racism and discrimination, just trying to make a living and trying to do the thing they love.
That's true. And I think, you know, often, so one of the things was recording contracts, right? The way that copyrights worked often was detrimental to Black musicians. So Duke Ellington, for instance, had a what we now know is a fairly exploitative relationship with his publisher, Irving Mills, where Mills would add his name to the composition copyrights and things like that to get, you know, part of the royalties. Or Jelly Roll Morton would later talk about the fact that he wrote the piece King Porter Stomp, but then Benny Goodman made a really famous recording of it in the 1930s. And like the way that the system was set up, you know, much of that money was going to Benny Goodman rather than to Jelly Roll Morton, the composer of this tune. And so there was really in addition to kind of daily incidences of racism, there were these financial barriers that caused significant problems. But Black musicians, you know, would try to work around or through or within the system as much as they could and find networks, ways of working together. So one of the things that I wrote about in an article that'll be coming out maybe next year, and I'm not the first person to talk about this, but Alberta Hunter, the blues vocalist, had the idea for Downhearted Blues, which was Bessie Smith's first recording for Columbia Records and was incredibly popular. I think Angela Davis writes that it sells something like 850,000 copies, which was a lot. But, you know, Alberta Hunter couldn't write music. And so she worked with Cora Lovey Austin, who was a band leader and pianist, to help her write down the tune. They kind of co-composed it and submitted it for copyright so that she could collect royalties. And so these kinds of networks of Black musicians working together. I just read an article the other day, or a chapter in a book about how Black women musicians, especially pianists, they were often pianists, were pretty skilled at this, notating these pieces and then submitting copyrights. And so they were an important part of how Black musicians would navigate the kind of financial structures. I think their role is sometimes overlooked in that. And I'll just add, with the Black musicians that we know or that often are exalted, like a Louis Armstrong or a Fletcher Henderson, the women that they worked with, so in Louis Armstrong's case, his wife at the time, Lil Hardin Armstrong, was a big catalyst for him starting his own group, the Hot Five group, the Hot Seven group, leaving King Oliver and going to New York to play with Fletcher Henderson before that. Fletcher Henderson's wife was an important part of his like organization, getting him to make recordings, to go on tour. And so there was a lot of, how do you deal with these issues of racism? But those kinds of things, networks, people sharing knowledge, I think is happening more than sometimes is discussed.
Well, Jonathan, what would you hope people might come away with from attending and experiencing this lecture on jazz in the 1920s at the Athenaeum Music and Arts Library?
I think what I'd like and what I found for myself and for my, you know, my musician colleagues and friends that I talk to is that despite the fact that the 1920s are now, I guess, 100 years ago, the music, you know, it remains incredibly exciting. And so in the lecture, I'm hoping not just to provide historical information in some context, but also just expose people maybe to recordings that they don't maybe gravitate to quite as much, but that are just as exciting and really far more adventurous, I think, than we give credit to these musicians. Some of the things Louis Armstrong was playing, or Coleman Hawkins, the great saxophonist, who was also a great composer, you know, really still excites me now, listening, right? 100 years later, I'm like, I can't believe they're playing this stuff, you know, in the 1920s. This is really incredible. And so I hope people come away not just with an interest in the history, maybe some books that they want to check out, but also an interest to continue listening more and explore more of the music. You know, I have an hour, so I can talk about a certain number of musicians, but there are so many who are playing and recording at the time. I hope people will continue to seek out more and more music.
Jonathan Gomez from the University of Southern California Thornton School of Music, thanks again for joining us on Inside Art.
Thank you, Dave.
Jonathan Gomez presents Jazz in the 1920s, Monday, April 10th at 5:30 p.m. at the Athenaeum Music and Arts Library in La Jolla. You can purchase tickets and learn more at ljathenaeum.org. Coming up, we'll preview a festival of short plays written by incarcerated playwrights at Donovan and Centinela prisons and staged next week at San Diego State University. Beyond Prison Walls is next as Inside Art continues here on San Diego's Jazz 88.3. Funding for Inside Art comes from the members of Jazz 88.3, where your support brings the joy and history of jazz and all of the arts to San Diego. To become a member, visit jazz88.org/donate.